Hope everyone enjoyed their lunch. We're just getting to 1 o'clock here now so we could get back started. Again, just a reminder that bathrooms are just right outside. There's going to be coffee and water still being served, so if you're thirsty, go ahead and help. Make sure to help yourself. We just have two more sessions left in the afternoon. We're going to start off here with our 1 o'clock session, the Developing an Effective Supervisory Program, joined by my colleagues Patty Cushing and Arthur Koenigstein. So we'll turn it over to Patty and Arthur. And Arthur, I know I butchered your last name, even though we just went through it, but we're right on it. Thank you.
Thank you, Joe. So I was keeping a tally this morning of how many times the word supervisor, supervise, supervision, or supervisory was said, and my grand total was 1,032. So it's not surprising that we now are having a panel that is strictly focused on developing a supervisory program. We're going to cover a lot of the same topics, but we're hoping that as we are talking about this, that you think about what it is exactly that is developing a supervisory program. So when you're doing that, we want you to think about the fact that you want to tailor your supervisory procedures for your operations. So regardless of what, sometimes when we are talking about our interpretive notices, we said it outlines the minimum standards that need to be in your supervisory program. Minimum standards. That's, you know, what we think you could see across all membership categories over all types of business. But you know your business best and how to best supervise it. You know, the whole purpose of NFA Compliance Rule 2-9 and the related interpretive notices is, yes, we want you to supervise your operations, but why? We want that so that you are, in general, in compliance with all the rules and regulations, which therefore leads to customer protection and the integrity of our marketplace. So, you know, we're not doing this just to meet 2-9, right? We've got a broader goal here. So as you're developing your program, tailor it. Also, you want to be prepared to pivot for changes. So when you've got a new line of business, how are you going to supervise that? When you have turnover, which if your firm was anything like others, we had a lot of turnover these last few years. What does that mean to your supervision? If you are blessed to work at a big firm that has a lot of compliance resources, well, who's helping you with your compliance? Are they experienced? Can they still do what that old person did for you? So make sure that you're able to, you know, shift for turnover, for new branches or employees. We talked about remote operations. We're going to get into that a little bit more in depth as we go on today. And then also, when you're developing your supervisory program, what can you actually accomplish? Don't put this beautiful, lovely, big procedure in place if you can't do it. If you don't have the right personnel, resources, systems to do it, then tailor that supervisory program for what you can actually accomplish. The best supervisory program is great. Again, maybe we're in compliance with the rules and we're not hurting anybody and we're helping the industry. But if you can't demonstrate that you've actually supervised something to an examiner, then it doesn't help us too much. So having logs in place, having emails that demonstrate that you've reviewed and approved something, keeping spreadsheets of things, whether it's trades that you've looked at, whether it's a spreadsheet of all the promotional material you've reviewed, correspondence relating to any inquiry, maintaining that in an organized fashion. This stuff helps that when you do have, somebody was talking about a recording that didn't get recorded, or something does fall through the cracks, you can say, yeah, but here's what I did do, and maybe it will help us in the long run say, okay, you have a decent supervisory program. It just so happened that this was an instance, an isolated situation. You know, so keeping those kinds of records is important. So as we go through everything, think about what you've already heard today and what we're going to go through, and just kind of keep these things in mind. How are you going to pivot for changes? How are you going to tailor things? And what records do you want to document in order to demonstrate your supervision? So let's talk a little bit more about written supervisory procedures. Here is a big list of procedures, not all inclusive, of course, but a lot of the procedures that we do review on our examinations. Many of these things we've talked about today. A couple more I want to highlight right now: registration of APs. How is it that you supervise that process? Not only who needs to be an AP, the supervisors we talked about earlier of those associated persons needing to be an AP, but what is the process you go through when you decide to get somebody registered? What due diligence have you done on that person? What background checks have you done? And why do we do that? We do that so that we can tailor our supervision of that person. Where did that person come from? Did they come from a firm that was previously disciplined for some reason? Well, that means they were trained by a firm that has disciplinary problems with the CFTC or NFA. Don't you want to retrain them to do things in a compliant manner? Or don't you want to be sure that they are supervised by somebody who is more senior at identifying those issues? So it's not just a matter of fill out the Form 8R and let NFA's background check do enough. It's your own review of their background to help you tailor your supervisory program. Customer complaints. How do you manage those? When a customer complains to you, is it okay that oftentimes when I say on an exam, do you have any customer complaints? They say, yeah, we got a complaint against this guy. We fired him. Oh, okay, well, poor guy. maybe he deserved it. But what other changes have you made in order to make sure that that same behavior doesn't happen again? Who taught that guy to begin with? Why didn't he know that he was doing something wrong? So look, use those customer complaints as a way to tailor things. What lessons did you learn from that? Maybe it was a rogue broker. These things happen. Knowing what caused it and what you can do differently to help avoid it in the future. So that's another good source of information for developing your supervisory program. When you are outlining your written supervisory procedures, some things to keep in mind. Again, use the interpretive notices as a guideline, as these are the minimum requirements you need to address. But then think about what is happening at your firm that maybe needs a little bit extra attention. Clearly define your employee roles. Who is responsible for reviewing what? Is it reasonable based on that person's title and authority? Don't have somebody overseeing your CEO on really big things if they don't, they're some tiny junior person. They're not going to be able to do an effective job of that. So really think about, is it reasonable based on people's title and experience? Are they supervising the right things? When you are doing reviews, you want to outline again in your written procedure, how frequently is the review going to be conducted? Let's say you're doing an email review. Are you going to look at a sample of every single employee every month? Are you going to have some sort of schedule of how often you're going to hit someone? Does it depend on what that person's duties are as to whether or not you're going to review their emails? How are you documenting that review? Again, things happen, things slip through the cracks, but if you can demonstrate to an exam team that you actually did have a good schedule and here's how often I reviewed, then that goes a long way in mitigating that deficiency. Is the firm following its procedures? We all know this, right? You can't go to a regulatory conference where it's not said. If you put it in writing, do it. That's the low hanging fruit. Even my most junior examiner can look at a procedure that says you are going to do X, Y, and Z, but you only do A and B, and they can cite you for it, right? So if it's in your procedure, follow it. And then also important is the escalation process. Again, if you are blessed to have a lot of people helping you with the supervisory responsibilities, do they know what needs to be raised to the CCO's attention? Do they know, who else needs to know about different issues? So be sure that you have that well outlined and communicated to people. This was touched on earlier. Entity-wide procedures are great. We know that many of you are part of larger corporate entities, and having a parent company's procedures is fine, but they do need to be specific to the registrant's operations. So cybersecurity is a big one that we see being corporate-wide, but you do need to be sure that the FCM or CPO's actual systems are included on that inventory list, that the risks associated with the data that you are collecting as a member is being identified and mitigated. So procedures that are entity-wide are acceptable, but they need to address, again, as I'm going to repeat myself 52 times, is they do need to be tailored to what the member is doing. All right, so Arthur, who is a manager in our New York office over exam staff, is going to share the next route.
Just checking. Okay.
It's on. Good afternoon, everyone. It's always tough to be the first panel after lunch, but thank you for bracing here with us, especially with the supervision, which I counted, Patty, you said it another 47 times, so we can up that tally. So I'm going to start off with the discussion of the supervision of remote operations. So this is really a concept that came about, given the world we've moved to the last couple of years. This really introduced us all to the remote work environment, includes working from home or the hybrid type work schedule, or some days you're in the office and some days you're not. Just hit the next slide. So this is a good place to start out. So really, as a result of this work environment that we're in now, in 2021, NFA updated the definition of a branch office. So just because a registered AP worked out of another location no longer meant that that location would have to be a listed branch office with the NFA, which is a bit of a change from what we're used to in the past. But more specifically, the amended definition excluded any location where one or more AP resides, and does not hold out that location to the public as an office location of the member firm itself. Customers are not met with, and also APs do not physically handle customer funds at this location. And then any NFA records that would be required would be available in accordance with NFA record keeping requirements at the main office. Go on to the next. Thanks, Patty. So as far as risk assessment, all members are required to diligently supervise their employees and registered APs and ensure that they have implemented an appropriate supervisory framework in place to adequately oversee them. These APs, especially those that are working remotely, again, you should consider the APs' experience, what their responsibilities would be while working remotely, what would be expected of them, what type of activities they would be performing, and also their background when determining if they should be working remotely. Again, also when even hiring a prospective employee and those that are expected to become registered APs, you should be conducting your own due diligence and verifying their employment history and any relevant prior experience that they do have. You need to determine if any disciplinary history or that the individual has or any firm that they worked at that has prior disciplinary history would potentially require additional oversight or supervision of this individual. And then based on all this information, you should determine if this is somebody that you feel should be working remotely, or do they potentially require additional oversight by somebody that's either in the main office or another listed branch of the firm. And just for specific requirements to the NFA rules, you can take a look at NFA Interp Notices 9010 And this talks about background checks and screening that should be done when determining if a prospective AP should be hired. And then there's also NFA Interp Notice 9019. And this discusses the supervisory procedures that should be in place around the hiring of prospective employees.
Nice. I moved it.
Next slide. Now, as far as additional supervision of remote operations, again, you should consider additional risks of having this person work remotely. And then you need to consider whether you need to adjust your written supervisory program based on the supervision you feel this individual or these individuals need that are working remotely. Update your written supervisory policies and procedures to adequately address whatever risks that you may identify and any areas of concern. And then, are you providing enough training on both your policies and procedures or all the regulatory requirements, or is more training needed? Should you be doing additional reviews of this individual or those individuals, APs, that are working remotely? Should you be speaking to them more frequently? Should you be checking up on them more? And this includes, you know, the handling of any customer orders or anything trading related. Should you be performing additional reviews of the work being done remotely? And you should really be asking yourself, are you doing enough? Are you comfortable with this person, you know, not having oversight on a day-to-day basis? And then just to summarize some of what we discussed, some general reminders. For those of you with APs in remote locations, again, the main office is responsible for all record-keeping requirements in compliance with NFA Rule 230, and these records must be made readily accessible to us on any NFA inquiry or exam. Any communications, such as emails, IM chats, phone recordings, messages, they must be saved through a system that's one able to capture it, retain it, and then make it easily accessible. And in compliance, of course, again, with the record-keeping requirements. And then finally, this was touched upon previously in the previous panel that discussed cyber. But again, are there additional cyber risks from these individuals working remotely, these APs? Now, cyber training is required in compliance with NFA Interp Notice 9070 when they're hired and annually thereafter. However, are you doing enough? We suggest, obviously, you do more, and more is always helpful. Do a phishing campaign, send out fake phishing emails, and if they click on these, then you know additional training is required. And of course, this should be done for all employees. Make sure they're up to date on any cyber developments or any regulatory updates. Again, the more information you provide individuals, both, again, working in the office, but especially those working remotely, the better you are as far as from a supervisory standpoint. And I'll pass it back to Patty now.
All right, so at the very first panel today, we talked a lot about trade communications and record keeping. So we are going to talk about it a little bit more because there are several supervision cases that our Business Conduct Committee has issued over the last year or more related to this area. So we do want to be sure that you are very clear on what your requirements are and think again about what changes do you have, what remote employees do you have, what's your business operation, are all your ducks in a row in this area. So as a reminder, IBs, FCMs, and swap dealers have to maintain recordings of any information that leads to an execution of an order. So what does that mean? Everyone needs to have any written communications, so chats, emails, anything of that nature that leads to the execution of an order. FCMs, IBs, swap dealers have to have that. FCMs, swap dealers, and people who meet the definition of a large IB also have to have oral recordings or recordings of all oral conversations that lead to an order. So keep this in a full, complete, systematic matter so that you know what's going on. The most interesting thing to me on one of the recent cases was that a broker was found to not being taped. All of his lines weren't being taped. And Cheryl mentioned this earlier. how was it that it went 6 months without anyone noticing that he wasn't being taped? And then I asked the question, how could this have happened? The customer that wasn't being taped was the firm's most active customer. How could this have gone unnoticed for 6 months? What are the checks and balances that you're putting in place? What is your risk assessment to decide which APs am I going to look at? You know, hey, this guy's got our biggest customer who trades the most. Maybe I should spend a little bit more time checking that out. So think about those types of things. What are things we found? Failure, not recording all lines. So this is getting less of an issue when everybody's at the main office and we have our main office lines being recorded. But we've got people working in remote locations and their lines were missing, or cell phones. That's a big hole that keeps happening, is that somebody's taking orders on a cell phone that isn't getting forwarded to a taped line. So really making sure that we have our arms around what it is that, how our brokers are communicating and how they are collecting that information. Not recording particular chat services. You know, if you've got it outlined, these are the four chat services we're going to use. Again, SpotCheck is my most active broker, and all of his customers actually using that chat service. Or is he somehow using a different chat service that we don't know about? How can you observe that? How can you have other people let you know that? So think about what processes you want to have in place to monitor that. Here's some of the actual supervisory failures we've seen. No written procedures to review communication. So, yeah, we're recording, but we have nothing in place to make sure that we're actually in compliance with our procedure. Not reviewing the communications at all. So that's the point of them, right? I mean, we're going to come in and listen to them and see what's being said. So maybe you as a supervisor should want to know what people are saying before we know. So making sure that you do look at a sample of communications to know what is typical behavior for that broker versus atypical. Not testing that you have the recordings, the chats, etc. Again, do a risk assessment. What brokers do I need to look at? How often? And what customers do I want to be sure that we are capturing the trades for? Not maintaining documentation to demonstrate supervision of trade communications. Again, did we just happen to pick the one trade that you're missing a communication from? Show me the logs after logs of everything you did review, and you just missed that one day. You know, that's pretty impressive. So it mitigates, like I said, these failures that can happen. All right, have we beat that topic to death yet? What do you think? All right, we'll move on. Common supervisory deficiencies.
Yes. And there'll be an underlying theme to some of the areas discussed here as far as supervisory deficiencies. Ultimately, to hit the nail on the head, you need to have a written supervisory program in place. It needs to be in line with your operations, and you need to be doing what you're saying you're doing and not just having it written down. So in the first area, the registering of APs, something we commonly see when we conduct an exam of our member firms is, one, there's no procedures in place as far as the supervision of remote operations with respect to registering APs and the registering of APs in general. Again, as Patty mentioned previously, we've seen member firms that just rely on NFA for the 8R background check that we do, and in hopes that if they pass that, then they're good to go. No, you need to be doing your own due diligence, your own background checks, employee verification, see if there's any prior disciplinary history that either the individual has or any of their previous employers, and again, verify all this information. We also see that member firms have APs that work remotely, but their written supervisory program does not reflect any additional supervision for these individuals. If you have employees that work remotely, your program needs to have cover the areas of how you're going to supervise these individuals. And finally, for those APs that are identified as having prior disciplinary history, there's nothing reflected in the program and no additional supervision is done. So if you do identify any individuals that either lack the experience that you think they need to work independently or have any prior disciplinary history or come from another firm that has prior disciplinary history and it comes into question, you know, do they need additional supervision? We've seen that nothing additional is done. So if you do identify an individual like this, make sure your program reflects it and you're implementing it. Now on to Bylaw 1101, which I'm sure everyone here knows, but if you do not, in essence, Bylaw 1101 states that you can't do business with a member that either requires is required to be registered but is not or is not claiming the proper exemption from registration. It's ultimately your responsibility to make sure that you're in compliance with this. So again, we come into exams and see that member firm's written supervisory program doesn't have anything in place for Bylaw 1101. They don't conduct any sort of due diligence. They don't do any checks. It's just, you know, hopefully they get lucky that they're doing business with somebody that doesn't need to be a member and they're in compliance that way. You need to be doing something. You need to do initial due diligence of your clients or if you operate pools, if you're pool participants. And something we commonly see done is at the account opening, there's some sort of attestation obtained from these either entities or individuals stating that they either are registered or if they're not registered and why. That's done initially. That's not enough on its own. You need to also be doing something on an ongoing basis. If you know you have a client or a participant that is claiming an exemption, you can check NFA's basic system and see if they're affirming annually their exemption, still that they're okay from being exempt from registration. If something changes there and they don't affirm it, you may want to speak to them and find out if anything has changed. Or again, you can send out an annual attestation to your clients and participants and asking them if anything's changed from the previous year. Are you still registered or are you no longer registered and why? Of course, when you bring on a client as well, you can do your own due diligence just to play it safe. You know, if somebody tells you that they're not required to be registered, if we come in and examine and ultimately find that registration is needed, you're still on the hook, and that would be a violation of Bylaw 1101. So you can do your own independent search, speak to them. If you feel they need to be registered, understand why they're telling you that they don't need to be. Is there an exemption that they qualify for that they're not claiming, or what's the specific reason why they're not registered with the NFA and CFTC?
And so, Arthur, you're talking about doing a review of who your customers, clients, and pool participants are, because by investing in commodities through you, they could be commodity pools, right? So Correct. We're looking at limited partnerships, LLCs. But, you know, Bylaw 1101 applies everywhere that you do business with people. So who's soliciting on your behalf? Are they registered introducing brokers, or are they exempt from being registered because they're broker-dealers and only soliciting for pool interests on your behalf? So you have to think about that. If you have customers, if you're an introducing broker and you have customers who have given power of attorney to a third party, does that third party need to be a CTA? So are they in the business of doing this, or is it just their family member, or do they qualify for an exemption, you know, less than 15 people in a year, those types of things. So don't just limit it to who are my customers, my pool participants, but others as well. We've also seen a slight uptick in promotional offers that large Forex dealer members and FCMs are offering to customers, like, you know, if you refer people to us, we'll give you $100 credit or something on your commissions. That's all well and good if they bring you one customer, but if you start having a customer that is referring, you know, 35 people in a month, how are they convincing these people? Have they now crossed over and become an introducing broker? So be careful of those type of promotional offers, that you're not setting yourself up for a potential Bylaw 1101 issue. Okay.
Thank you, Patty. So the next area, cybersecurity. And again, some of this was touched in the previous panel with Julio and Katie and earlier today. But some common deficiencies in the area of cybersecurity when it comes to supervision is, one, again, not having procedures in place, but two, not following them. So for example, and this is something I've firsthand seen on an exam, if you state, your procedures state that you don't allow any work devices to use USBs. We would test this. So in an exam, we went in and took a USB and plugged it into the computer, and to the shock of the firm, it worked. It popped up. We were able to transfer files back and forth. So this is a clear situation where the firm was not following the procedures they had in place.
We had some right that they said they were going to do penetration testing, too. I mean, that's a big deal to do penetration testing. That requires a lot of resources, and they weren't doing it. Of course they weren't doing it. They didn't, you know, again, this goes back to make sure that your supervisory program is something that you can actually do.
Right. A lot of this language is included in the interp notice, and make sure it's just not a template of what's available on our website, or if you're using someone else's as a resource, make sure what's in there you're actually doing and able to really, if we come and exam, if we question it, provide a support and evidence that this procedure works and is in place. And one of the most common ones, of course, we see is supervising your operations to ensure that training is provided upon new hire and then annually thereafter. For example, if your procedures state that you'll provide new hires cyber training within a week of employment, well, we ask for support, and of course, this is not being done. This is a clear violation of not being able to substantiate your procedures.
And Arthur, I'm seeing some procedures who say, like, in the first 6 months of hire, NFA wouldn't let us go 2 hours after being hired where we haven't done cybersecurity training. I mean, you know, really think, is that appropriate for what they have access to the, are you really willing to risk that for 6 months this person doesn't know not to click on a phishing email? So think about that.
Yeah, NFA wouldn't let you leave your first day without taking their internal cyber training. And of course, 6 months, you're exposing yourself to that additional risk unnecessarily. The interp doesn't define it, but you need to think to yourself, is 6 months for a new hire training really sufficient?
And I'm going to say no. It's not.
And the same goes for annual training, cyber training that needs to be done once a year. We ask for support, and of course, we are provided evidence that it's not taking place once a year. That, you know, there's gaps in between. It's done, for example, 2020, and then we come in now, and we're given something for 2022. So, of course, training was not provided in 2021. So just make sure that all, as Julio kind of covered, who is required to take training, make sure all those individuals are adequately taking the training that's required. And it's anybody who has access to your networks, your files, your email, all those individuals need to take the appropriate cyber training.
And if we did an exam of you and cited you for not doing annual training, make sure it doesn't happen again. You know, when we come in for that second exam, that you've actually remediated that issue. You don't want it to show up in a second exam. It won't go well. So, you know, anytime we give you deficiencies, everything should be, you know, look at your supervisory program and go, how can I make sure this exact same thing doesn't happen again? Because that's a quick way to get disciplinary action, is by having repeat deficiencies, not correcting the deficiency. Thought I better clear that up. Okay.
And then third-party service providers, and Katie touched upon some of this in the previous panel, but again, Interp Notice 9070 was released in September of 2021, and while it's still relatively new, it's really not anymore. So a common thing we see when we come to our exams, and the most common, is not having supervisory procedures in place regarding overseeing those third-party service providers that are you're outsourcing regulatory obligations to. Again, these procedures should be in place, and when we come into an exam now, if we don't see it, it's a site, and corrective action will need to be provided to us during the course of the exam. We also find that those that do have procedures in place are not following them. So it discusses the initial due diligence, it discusses the ongoing due diligence of any key third-party service providers that are used, and when we ask for this support, nothing is provided. No due diligence was done initially. No due diligence was done, you know, going forward. So please, if you say you're doing it, well, you have to do it because it's required. So make sure you are doing it. But something else we see members not taken into account for, and again, Katie touched upon this too, but is not having a backup plan in place. So the third-party service provider you hire isn't able to fulfill the regulatory obligation. Again, you're on the hook for that obligation. It doesn't fall on the third-party service provider. So you would need to have a plan in place to come into compliance, whether it's providing any regulatory filings to the NFA. You'll have to come up with, if you had someone else do it for you, you'll either have to do it yourselves or have a plan in place to make sure those are submitted to us timely. And then one last comment thing, again, it kind of goes hand in hand, cyber, not taking into account the additional cyber risks that are as a result of using these third-party service providers. So they're provided with, you have to understand the information you're providing them, the data you're giving them. Is there any PII and really the additional risks this may cause? Because you want to make sure this information is protected. Because again, if they have a service, a cyber breach, now your information is potentially exposed to this hack. So you want to make sure that you take this into account. How do you make sure that your information is provided? Do you look at their cybersecurity plan they have in place and gain comfort that what they have in there, they'll be able to protect your data and your information? So this is something that you need to consider, and we can't stress enough that you want to make sure you protect whatever data you make available to anyone. And I'll pass it back to Patty.
Yeah, and the last thing that I'd like to highlight with respect to third parties is, what's your plan for terminating the relationship with a third party? So when you do make a switch, how do you cut off access to things? How do you make sure that your data remains secure after you've ended the relationship? So part of the interpretive notice does require that written agreements address that. So just be sure that you do have all that worked out, you know, before it happens. All right. I think you've heard enough about supervision over and over and over again today, but it bears repeating. Like I said, supervision ends up being a component in most of our disciplinary cases. You know, it's not just the behavior itself, but that the firm allowed it to happen. So we do want to stress again that when you have operational changes, you need to adjust your supervisory program. When you have an increase in staff, how are you going to handle that? When you have a decrease in staff, did you lose key personnel, and who's going to step in and supervise that activities now? When you purchase new technology, how are we adjusting our cybersecurity program for it? How are we adjusting for for all of our other record keeping requirements? So be sure we address that. When we enter new markets, many of you are compliance folks, and the business folks come in and say, oh, we're doing this, and you've got 3 days to figure it out. Hopefully you have a good relationship with the business side, and they can give you more advanced notice than that, but adjust your procedures accordingly. And then, as we talked about, opening a new branch or having remote employees, what does that do to our supervisory program? What adjustments do we need to make now? So those are some tips on developing an effective supervisory program. If you have questions, we'd love to hear them.
I had two questions that kind of hopefully roll into each other. Regarding the branches, if you have APs who are remote, and I'm going to put it this way, so remote it's really hard for them to get into a branch, are the expectations that a supervisor should go there to their home and conduct the reviews? What are the expectations from the regulator?
So does the person meet the definition of a branch office, or are they just... or do they meet an exception? from being a branch.
That's what I'm trying to figure out.
Well, if you've got the three prongs, right, if they don't meet with customers there, if they don't accept customer funds, and what's the third one, Arthur? If you're able to maintain the records at the main office, then they can, and it's a single employee, right? They can be remote if you think that's appropriate. But if they're using your systems and you can, you know, monitor them that way, that might be acceptable. I mean, it just depends what they're doing, what their background is, and how comfortable you are. If you feel that they need more direct supervision and they can't get to a branch, then you probably do want to visit them more frequently.
Okay. And then my last question is regarding the training, the annual training in the cyber. Mm-hmm. Are you looking to see two distinctly separate training plans, or can you roll the cyber into the annual?
The cyber into the annual training that you have overall? Yeah. It can be together.
Okay.
You just want to be able to demonstrate, you know, show us the outline of everything that was covered and how, and any training materials that were distributed.
Okay. Thank you.
I'm not hearing it.
Niche sectors is that, you know, people who clients and counterparties might not just be clients but also personal friends. Mm-hmm. And two people are working from home, one may well come over to, you know, the client may well come to the salesperson's house for lunch. So to what extent do we really mean that we can't have any customers coming to a remote location as part of the remote location status?
Well, you're on a slippery slope there. Right. So I'm going to be conservative and say if you don't think you can monitor that, they should be a branch. What's it hurt? You list them as a branch office and you have to do an inspection every once in a while. I mean,
unless you're sure it's a personal lunch and not a business lunch, then. But I would agree with Patty. Take the conservative approach.
I work with a self-directed broker-dealer. We're in the option space now. We're dipping our toes into futures. The thing that we're supervised most for by FINRA for options is approval of customer accounts. I'm wondering, does NFA have specific rules you'd point us to with anything resembling a suitability obligation? What are we likely to encounter in terms of meeting the prescriptions from NFA for customer approval?
That's a great question. NFA has NFA Compliance Rule 2-30, which is a Know Your Customer rule. It is not a suitability requirement like yours. If you read the interpretive notice that's associated with 230, it kind of talks about the fact that futures is just its own class of risk, right? And unlike, you know, on the FINRA side, there's lots of different products with lots of different risk profiles, and so you might decide somebody's suitable here but not there. On futures, we sort of say you probably, if you're not good for this, a corn contract, you're probably not good for a S&P contract either. So it's not really suitability. It's called our additional risk disclosure. You gather certain pieces of information about your customer and make an assessment as to whether or not they need additional risk disclosure. But it does say in there that you can make the decision that futures is just not appropriate for someone. But you should have a 230 written procedure that kind of says what is the criteria where you want to provide additional disclosure, what is the criteria where you would just say, no, this isn't the business we want. You're welcome.
Regarding the cybersecurity training, how do we determine if a person have the right qualifications to offer the cybersecurity?
It ultimately comes down to due diligence and you gaining comfort that the provider will able to, again, for what you're doing as a firm operationally, provide you your cyber needs. As Julio mentioned, we don't endorse or we don't recommend any specific providers. It really comes down to the membership determining that you know, the content they're providing us, this fits or in what we do, and these are the risks that we are ourselves identified as potential cyber risks. And again, the interpret doesn't specifically say what needs to be in it. It's just that cyber, you need to figure out what works for you.
And the second question, I thought I heard, as far as if there's a vendor who has PII, and then there's a vendor change, you're saying that there needs to be some type of a termination agreement. Are you trying to safeguard the data that's at that vendor, or what does that look like?
Yeah, the interpretive notice says that when you have a written agreement, your written agreement should address the termination of the agreement with that third party. And the things that you need to consider is, how do you cut off access by that vendor to your information, and what are they going to do with your data? Again, you just need to know what they're going to do and how they're going to keep it secure and keep monitoring that, right? You don't want to just say, because I'm no longer working with them, I'm done. I mean, that data was your data. So make sure that it's still secure.
And the interp notice is a good point of reference. So if you look at the interp notice on our website, there's a whole section that covers the termination portion, and that will outline specifically what's needed.
And that's going to have to be our last question. We're at time.
It went so fast.
Patty and Arthur will be available if you guys have any other questions, but we could keep moving along.